It's episode 39 of the Planet LP podcast. This is the place where we drop the needle on a world of albums. I'm Ted Asfragadu, and on this episode, I'll be talking to author Bill Kopp, whose recent book on the history of a record label in San Francisco during the early 80s paved the way for the mainstreaming of a genre that grew out of the punk rock anarchy of the late 70s. And that genre was new wave music. Hey, if you're feeling social, follow Planet LP on Facebook. We're just at Planet LP. If you're on Twitter, the handle is ThePlanetLP. And that's the same for Instagram. If you want to get in touch with me, go ahead. I'm at Ted@PlanetLP.com. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast, which is on most noted platforms like Apple, Odyssey, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, Audible, and even Facebook. Okay, I think we've got all the business sorted. Let's get on with the show. Bill Kopp, welcome to the Planet LP podcast.
Hi, Ted. Thanks so much for having me on.
Oh, yeah. Wonderful book. I really enjoyed this ride. Your book is called Disturbing the Peace, 415 Records and the Rise of New Wave, published by Hozak Books. You cover a time in music history that doesn't get a lot of ink unless you're writing about bands that were at the top of the new wave game in the 80s. Bands like, and I'm going to mention a lot of them that most people will know, The Cars, Duran Duran, Blondie, Pretenders, The Police, B-52s, New Order, The Cure, The Clash, Devo. The list will go on. Now, those bands, for the most part, are the iconic ones now. However, you write about names that aren't very well known. A few include The Nuns, Pearl Harbor and the Explosions, The Mutants, Popple Pies and the Uptones, and some who are noted, like I know Romeo Void, and I know the Red Rockers, Translator, Wire Train, and Until December. So what got you interested in covering this particular time, which is the 1980s or early 80s, this particular place, which is San Francisco, and these particular people, which is some of the bands that I mentioned?
To date myself, the first half of the 1980s was my college era. Mm-hmm. So when college rock, quote unquote, was becoming a thing, that's really what I was listening to. In particular, Translator's album, Evening of the Harvest, and Wire Train's album, Between Two Words, really were kind of the soundtrack of my college years. So I've always had a major affinity for the sort of, quote unquote, alternative music of that particular era. I wasn't listening to classic rock type stuff.
So the arena rock era of like Foreigner or AC/DC or Rush and that sort of thing, that wasn't your jam, as it were.
Not too much. I mean, I'm really into progressive rock as well. But yeah, that stuff sort of in the middle, the corporate stuff, really never moved me a whole lot.
What was it about that label, the 415 label, that made you want to say, you know, there's a story to be told here about this particular time and this particular label? How did that happen?
Actually, what happened was in around October of year before last, a small reissue label called Liberation Hall started doing some reissue and compilation releases of material from the earliest days of 415 Records. Mm-hmm. And I received a press release about that and thought, gosh, that's really, really interesting. And at the time, I was writing a lot for SF Weekly. And I thought, gosh, this would be a really good story for them. I already knew about 415 because, as I'd mentioned, Translator and Wire Train, two of my favorite bands, were on the label. They were on 415/CBS, which is the sort of the later period, kind of the second half of the 415 story. The piece that I ended up writing for SF Weekly's Thanksgiving Week issue of 2020 didn't focus on those at all, because these reissues were strictly of the really early material that, to put it bluntly, CBS/Sony didn't have rights to. So I didn't talk to any of the later bands. I talked to a number of people from the early groups, including, perhaps most significantly, Jack Cassidy, who most people will know as the bassist in Jefferson Airplane and the bassist in Hot Tuna, but he was also in a sort of proto power pop new wave band called SVT.
Right.
They released material on 415. So I did that story for SF Weekly, but just in the process of doing a half dozen or so interviews and speaking with 415's founder, Howie Klein, I knew, gosh, this is such, I mean, it was sort of like I just peeled back a single layer of an onion. And there was so much more to this that I was fascinated just for my own interest that I wanted to know more about all this. And I thought, gosh, the opportunity to talk to the guys in Translator again, because I have written about them before, and to potentially track down the guys from Wiretrain and so on and so on, that would be really interesting. So I put together a book proposal in December of 20. And by Christmas, I had a book deal.
Okay.
That's not how it usually happens.
No, it doesn't. Usually happen that quickly.
No, no.
You got an editor's attention who said, "There, now there's a story. I want to know more about that." And if you've got access to people who can tell that story and archives with flyers and album covers, and the book is peppered with so much visual, stunning visual stuff from that era. It just really reminds me of my teen years. I'm a bit younger than you are. I was in high school at the time that you're writing about these bands. And I live in the Bay Area. And so I used to go to the city once I had a driver's license. And my friends and I, we would just walk around because we were too young to get into some of these clubs. You had to be over 18. There weren't a lot of all ages stuff. Plus, we were just suburban kids. You know, we were still in our IZODs and just looking really out of. Okay, let's put it this way. We just weren't cool enough to hang with the punks. It wasn't going to happen. But we just loved the whole scene. I mean, we're just taking it all in, just soaking it in sort of visually and thinking, these are the coolest people. And we used to take the posters off the lampposts and put them in our lockers, like on Monday morning after coming back from our adventures in the city. So when I'm looking through the pages of your book and I'm seeing some of these flyers, of course, some of them I didn't have, but it's the styles that were used to get people's attention to say, you know, this band will be playing at this club. A lot of them were pretty funny. I mean, they're very irreverent. They're kind of oddball, but that's what we loved about it because it just felt like, well, this is not something you're going to hear on rock radio. These bands, you're just not going to hear them. But you talked about Howie Klein. He was one of a few people that sort of spearheaded this 415 record venture. Chris Knab is another one, David Kahn, Butch Bridges, and Queenie Taylor. Now, these were the people who, as they said, didn't know shit about the record business, but they learned fast how the story unfolds and how you tell it.
Howie had experience with the music business, quote unquote, not the record business. He had been activities director when he was in college at Stony Brook University in New York. And as I talk about briefly in the beginning of the book, he was booking bands like The Doors.
Yeah.
And
he got them cheap, too.
He got them really cheap, $400.
The Doors. Okay.
He booked The Fugs, which didn't go over well with everyone. You know, he was just involved in the counterculture very, very early on. He had certainly experience with that. And as I also get into, he did a lot of radio work, doing a lot of DJing at both and live DJing too at clubs, spinning records. And that's how he came into connection with Chris Knab. He was a frequent customer at Aquarius Records, and one thing led to another. And then, you know, eventually the two of them were championing a lot of these bands, a lot of whom, it should be noted, weren't sending records into the radio station because they didn't have records. They were sending cassette tapes.
Right.
That that microphone in the middle of the room kind of recordings that some of us may remember from those days. I think for Howie and Chris, who really were the main two guys, it was just that starting 415 was simply the next logical step in trying to champion and advocate for these musicians whose work they really loved and respected and wanted to encourage and nurture.
You spotlight this time in San Francisco And I don't remember who the quote was from. It may have been from Howie. It may have been from Chris. But they were talking about San Francisco as a music town, what it was like to be a musician in this city, in San Francisco, at a time when LA and New York were these cities, were the music towns where people were, where the bands were trying to make it big. And the quote was something like this. You have to understand that San Francisco at the time, and we're talking about the early 80s, was a very provincial town. There weren't a lot of places that new bands could play. In fact, a lot of these bands, these new wave or post-punk bands from the late 70s to the early 80s, had maybe five clubs they could play at. And most of them were located in San Francisco. There was one in Palo Alto, which is near where Stanford University is. It was called the Keystone. I believe there was a Berkeley Square. So you had Berkeley, you had Palo Alto, and you had San Francisco. But among them, it was like five clubs, and that was it. And that was something I didn't realize, how limited these bands were in terms of getting in front of an audience.
I think that worked for and against the bands in some ways, mostly for, I would argue. It's hard now to imagine a pre-internet world.
Right.
The cities were a lot more cut off from one another. If you lived in a given city, I lived in Atlanta at the time, I would occasionally pick up an issue of New York Rock or something. And so I had, in sort of an abstract sense, an idea of what was going on in New York and Chicago and LA and things like that. But it somehow didn't really seem real, and it was removed from my reality. And I think the same was true for the San Francisco bands, even though in some ways someone may, with the benefit of hindsight, say that, oh, San Francisco band, fill in the blank, had some of the same musical qualities that a band from LA or this band from New York City had. They may or may not have even known about each other. And that's just the way that the scenes were. Take Translator, for example. They actually were an LA band who decided to move to San Francisco because San Francisco was, in their eyes, more community-minded, less competitive, and less focused on the cynical commercial side of things and more art for art's sake. It had a particular quality. And then you take the Red Rockers, they were from New Orleans. They went to San Francisco for kind of the opposite reason, because San Francisco was a bigger market than New Orleans and certainly a more fertile one for the kind of music they were making as sort of the American Clash, which is what they were to some extent in their earliest days.
Now, you talked about the way in which things were kind of provincial, and this is a pre-internet world. So, like you said, you were living in Georgia at the time, and you could pick up a music magazine about New York and be somewhat introduced to bands that are in New York. And if you saw maybe a notice about a band from San Francisco, you go, okay, interesting. But now we're so connected that it's easy to find out information about whatever you want, to the point where it's almost paralyzing. It's difficult to focus on what exactly am I trying to find information on. Think about the way in which the music industry, especially in San Francisco, worked at the time. I mean, okay, you had the bands, you had radio stations, you had music stores that sold the product, and you also had some clubs. So that was kind of the economy there. One of the radio stations was KSAN. They were a freeform station from 68 to 1980, and they went under the name of Jive 95 back then. And because I'm a radio guy, when you talked about KSAN changing from freeform, which is when Howie was working there, Howie Klein, and playing a lot of these bands that he was hearing about on that radio station to get people excited about these finds that he was finding, to a more formatted radio. This was, I'm guessing, 81-ish or 82, somewhere around there, where they were starting to change. There's a part in your book where Howie Klein blew his ride hosting a show called The Outcasts. Now, I want to read a part from your book, which I found very funny. He says, and you're quoting him, he said, all my comrades at KSAN had already either quit or been fired. Howie recalls, I was the last person left. I had mouthed off in the Bay Guardian about KSAN sucking. So the new program director called me in and said that I was fired. And quotes the program director, your program doesn't really go with what we're doing anymore. Klein asked him, had you ever actually listened to his show? And he said, no. So I said, well, why don't you listen to the show and get back to me after you hear it and tell me what doesn't go? The programmer agreed. Howie delivered the inevitable punchline. 2 weeks later, he called me in and said, I heard your show. You're fired. And one of the things, there was a guy, really popular DJ at the time, named Dr. Donald Rose. He was on a station called KFRC in San Francisco. At the time, he was one of the highest paid DJs. And I had worked for him later in the late 80s for a station in Concord. And he said to me once, you're nobody in radio until you get fired. So I think that was the moment where Howie became a somebody. You know, he got fired from radio so then he could move on and start 415 Records.
Howie was full of stories like that.
So I feel like it's the start of taking his deep interest in music, especially in post-punk music, and realizing there's something here. There's something that more people should be aware of, more people should listen to, and there's a business opportunity here. Now, I don't know if he ever thought, I'm going to get rich starting a record label. It sounds like he and the others started it just as a passion project, really.
That's absolutely right. And I can tell you, he didn't, according to what he told me, and there's every reason to believe him, he didn't believe that he was going to get rich. And in fact, he did not from 415, certainly. Later, he did. That's a different story.
Right. I think when he became associated with CBS and then started his music career and heading up Reprise.
Right. Yeah. He didn't see any appreciable return on his efforts during the CBS era. It was when as that ended and when he went on to Warner Reprise and various things like that.
You talked about the Red Rockers earlier, and there are a lot of bands you spotlight in your book who didn't last long. In fact, the vast majority of them did not. But there are a few that had some staying power. So talk about Romeo Void and the Red Rockers for a moment, because one band, that would be Romeo Void, had this odd-sounding song that kind of hit. I don't know, right place, right time or something. And the other, the Red Rockers, had a very conventional sounding song. I remember China getting a lot of airplay, and they were on MTV as well. But they were both on the 415 record label. Romeo Void was from San Francisco, the Bay Area, but the Red Rockers were not. But talk about these bands and how their sound seemed to, I don't know, catch fire. And I don't know if it was right place, right time for them.
For Romeo Void, Howie discovered them. He was walking by Bubuhay Gardens one day when the band was inside rehearsing. He and Lester Bangs, him having to deal with an extremely drunk Lester Bangs is in the book. But Romeo Void really did kind of capture the zeitgeist of the era, and they didn't sound like anybody else. When I look back at that period, I can really only think of two bands in the sort of new wave, post-punk kind of style that used saxophone in a way that wasn't, if you'll forgive me, cheesy.
Yeah.
because I think of things like Harden My Heart by Quarter Flash and mm-hmm. pretty much any Billy Joel tune of the era you'd care to name as being that sort of big hair, shoulder pads kind of saxophone.
It had a lounge quality to it,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
But then on the other hand, you had the Psychedelic Furs and you had Romeo Void, who had very distinctive saxophone parts as a central component of their music. And that really set them apart. Plus, Deborah, who's a fantastic vocalist with a very inimitable style, and her approach to lyrics was very, very forthright, and that set them apart from other bands as well. The early success of Romeo Void is what led, not a dotted line, but a solid line from their early success. That's what led to the 415 CBS deal. The majors took notice. To that point, it's like, yeah, there's this indie label in San Francisco. Yeah, that's nice. When Romeo Void started to catch fire, all of a sudden the offers started coming in. And that's really what led to the major label deal.
I knew that they had crossed that line from avant-garde to mainstream when I was watching this movie back in 84 called Reckless, which was starring Aidan Quinn and Daryl Hannah. And they had that song featured in the film. It was during a part, I believe they were at a pool After Hours and dancing around to this song. And I'm all like, wow, they're playing Romeo Void on the soundtrack. And he's like, my God, this is 84. And so it felt fairly new because it was.
That probably would have been A Girl in Trouble is a Temporary Thing. That's what
Played Never Say Never. They did play Never Say Never. Yeah, they did. It was on the soundtrack. Yeah.
Wow. Okay, because it had been out for some time by that point. You know, Never Say Never didn't sound like anything else on the radio. You hear it once. People may not even necessarily now remember the song by its title, but if you quote the signature line of the song, they'll go, oh, that song.
Yeah, I might like it better if we slept together. I might like it better if we slept together. Okay, so I was a suburban kid, so that was the other thing about this pre-internet days, kids. It took a while for certain songs and bands to kind of make their way out to the suburbs. I had first heard Never Say Never maybe a year before that. A friend of mine had the record, and so he used to play it, and he put it on a tape, and I had the cassette. So, but when I saw the movie Reckless in 84, I just thought that it was a fairly new-ish song, but I thought, wow, they're playing this song in a mainstream movie. It just felt like the music that I glommed onto and was really into at the time was starting to cross over and being incorporated into mainstream films. So,
yes,
and especially this band, which it's an odd sounding song. It really is. She's not really singing.
She certainly can sing, but in that one, it's more speak singing. And the Never Say Never EP actually came out in 1981.
Oh, wow.
So there was something of a lag time. But of course, the 80s was that period of aggregating songs that either had been hits or had the potential to be bigger hits and putting them on soundtracks.
And what about Red Rockers? How did they break through to the MTV era? Was it just that they had a kind of a cool looking video, or because the song was catchy? China.
That's an interesting story in itself. In the earliest days, Red Rockers were a punk band. A left-wing political punk band. And they sounded a lot like The Clash, except the vocals were a little bit easier for American ears to decipher. They were unabashedly political. Their first album, which at this moment is still exceedingly rare, you'll pay $50, maybe $100 for a used copy. Very, very hard to find. It's a punk record. It sounds a lot like the first Clash record, but just with different songs. Once the CBS deal came around, and that first record, Condition Red, was released on 415 full stop. That predates the 415 Columbia era. When 415 inked a deal with CBS, suddenly Red Rockers become 415 Columbia artists, and they were interested in larger success. And so with help of producer David Kahn, who was really instrumental, he gets co-credit on a lot of the songs that they even wrote during that period. They moved in a significantly more mainstream kind of new wave direction, and in the process lost a lot of their punk fan base, but arguably opened themselves up to a much, much larger fan base and enjoyed some MTV era success.
They sure did. I saw that video quite a bit on MTV. They played it not quite in high rotation. I would say it was like a medium rotation thing. Person who looms large over the pages of your book was Bill Graham. I mean, he's not featured very much in the story, but his name comes up a lot. I couldn't decide if he was a kind of a monopolist who really ruled the town with a iron fist, or someone who was a real supporter of Klein and others at 415 Records. Maybe a little of both.
I would say a lot of both, actually. The answer to that question depends on whose perspective you draw upon. Queenie Taylor, who would eventually be a partner with 415, she wasn't there at the very beginning. She worked for Bill Graham Presents in her spare time, would help Howie and Chris out. She was responsible for booking a lot of the 415 bands into Bill Graham-owned venues, which were the highest profile and quote-unquote best venues in town at the time.
And you compare that, or at least contrast that, with like the Mabuhay Gardens, which was one of the focal points of where a lot of these bands got their start, the bands that you profile. But they couldn't get into the Bill Graham clubs.
Some of the bands that I interviewed looked upon the Bill Graham venues as kind of a closed shop. and they were on the outside of that door. Some of them eventually did get in. But then on the other hand, Bill Graham was supportive of what Howie and Chris were doing. There were a number of people who we might think of as rock's old guard who were either tacitly or quietly very supportive. Paul Kantner from Jefferson Airplane and Starship was another one who was a big supporter of a lot of what was going on there. And from what I'm told, if you wandered into the Mabuhay to see some of these bands, if you looked left, you might see Paul Kantner. And if you looked right, you might see Jello Biafra.
Another name that comes up a lot, Jello Biafra, you quote quite a bit in your book. You want to call him almost like a mayor of San Francisco music. I mean, he's really into these bands. I mean, tell us a little bit about who Jello Biafra was at the time and who he is today.
In the earliest part of the story, as I'm chronicling it, he was a customer, a frequent customer at Aquarius Records, buying punk records. That the band that he was in, Dead Kennedys, he was the lead singer. He was the singer. He was a really prominent fixture on the music scene. Many, many, many of the 415 bands shared bills with the Dead Kennedys in those days. So as an articulate observer of the scene as it was happening, he was someone who I was very, very pleased to be able to talk to. He left the Dead Kennedys many, many years ago and has gone on to a career as a head of his own label, Alternative Tentacles, and as a spoken word artist, and as a continued articulate commentator on culture. And of course, in fact, he did run for mayor of San Francisco way back in the day. Yeah. And I remember reading about that at the time, that I think one of the planks in his platform is that businessmen would have to wear clown suits.
That's pretty good. Pretty good. So I have a bit of a Bill Graham story to tell you, and it has to do with 415 Records. I was part of the early part of this site called Popdose, which still exists, and I write for it occasionally, but I used to do this series called Mix Six. And what I would do is I would mix six songs together, and they would usually have a theme. The important part of it was that these songs seemed to go well together. They seemed to mix well together, like a DJ would do. And that's because of my radio background. Did this on a weekly basis. And one time I spotlighted 415 Records. It was all the artists like New Math and Mutants, Translators on there, Red Rockers, and of course Romeo Void, but also Until December was featured. That was one of the first songs on the mix. So I'll read you what I wrote about meeting Bill Graham that I wrote on Popdose. The first time I heard of this band, and that is Until December, was when they performed at the Bay Area Music Awards, the BAMMIES, in 1987. I was a young pup at a radio station in Concord, California. We got invited to the BAMMIES in San Francisco, where I briefly met Bill Graham when we were accidentally shown to his table. He looked confused as to who we were and why the hell we were sitting at his table. My boss walked up to him and introduced himself and talked about how we were playing a few artists on the 415 label and gave him his card. Bill was polite, but he knew it was a mistake. After all, why would three of the unwashed masses from Concord be sitting at his table? About 5 minutes later, someone escorted us to our real seats as Until December took the stage. What I remember about their performance, there was lots of mood lighting, lots of mysterious affectation, but ultimately a really great three-song set featuring the song Free Again, Heaven, and Until December. I bought the album the next day, even though I should have gotten it for free. After the band broke up, lead singer Adam Sherburn started the politically left hip-hop group called Consolidated, which, on one of their songs off their debut album, I'm pretty sure they sampled the turn signal noise from a San Francisco City bus or the Muni buses, because I could hear it on there being repeated over and over. But that was a time we met Bill Graham briefly. But he was nice. He shook our hands, but he was like, look, who the hell are these people? Why are they here? But the BAMMIES were fun. It was really cool to see all those people that were sort of rock luminaries. I know Sammy Hagar was there, and he, you know, they kind of got on stage at the end and they jammed. And it was an exciting time in music because it felt like San Francisco was kind of coming into its own as a music town. Unfortunately, that was sort of short-lived because I would say by the 90s, it wasn't so much anymore.
That's a great story. I love that story. You mentioned Consolidated, which was the band that sort of came after Until December.
Yeah.
On their first EP, they also, another thing that they sampled was a quote from Howie Klein. The track is called Howie Livin'. In it, there's a sample of Howie Klein, who at the time was the president of Warner Reprise Records. And he says,
"If music is just inspired by a desire to make money, how interesting could it really be?"
And Consolidated's albums were always took on big business, big government. I mean, one of their albums was called Friendly Fascism, and it was just a real diatribe. But it was also very melodic and poppy in many ways, and funny too. The first proper release for Consolidated on their album, they really kind of skewered Brian Wilson a lot and his relationship with Dr. Landy, that kind of featured prominently in there. But I knew that Consolidated, there were two members from Until December that went on to do Consolidated, and Adam went from singer to sort of rapper. It was an interesting change, and I really dug their first three albums, actually. They were quite good. A group that I didn't know about, well, there's many that I didn't know about in your book, but the Nuns were fronted by, at least with the pictures tell the story, but the music is a little different, but a woman named Jennifer Miro. Pretty glamorous looking woman. I mean, to me, I looked at her images in your book and I'm like, my God, she's like a San Francisco version of Debbie Harry. Just stunning. But yes. She wasn't really a punk rocker or a new waver. She kind of wasn't really into that scene too much, it seemed like.
Jennifer Miro came from much more of a kind of a mainstream background. The Nuns, who in their earliest days could barely play, according to most accounts, were a true punk band. They essentially had three lead singers. Mm-hmm. So it depended on the particular song who was fronted. Certainly Jennifer was the most visually arresting member of the group. They had a guitarist named Alejandro Escovedo, who has since gone on to much greater fame as a solo artist. Some people call him the kind of the king of the Austin music scene.
Oh, okay.
The Nuns, their story is very much entwined with the story of another band who were not on 415 called the Dills. The Nuns were really, really important to that early punk scene in San Francisco. Unlike some of the bands, you mentioned the Mutants, the Nuns didn't really have quite the art school foundation. They were more just sort of straight ahead punks, with a bit, we'll say, of a New York flavor.
Jennifer really looked sophisticated. She was born in Mill Valley, which is in the Bay Area. It's in Marin County, right, in 1957. She's no longer alive. She died in 2011, I believe, from cancer. I just looked at some old YouTube videos when they were playing like Winterland in 1978. You can just Google that or go on YouTube and look for it. They did a pretty good set. She did a song called Savage, which was one of their more pop-infused songs. But her voice was good. Her stage presence was really good at the time, too, because she was sitting behind a piano. What I took away from watching them on stage was that new wave post-punk bands of that era, especially the ones you spotlight in the book, are way more multicultural than the more mainstream new wave versions of bands were being sold to essentially white suburban kids around the country. But I'm looking at the pages through your book and I'm like, wow, there's a lot of people from different ethnicities in these new wave post-punk bands. And I don't know if that's a unique thing to San Francisco of that music scene, or if that was the case for new wave post-punk in other cities like Los Angeles or New York.
Well, I can't really speak specifically to the scenes in those other cities, but I do think, based on what I gleaned from all the people that I interviewed, was that the music scene in San Francisco really just sort of reflected the culture, the eclecticism, and the cultural breadth of the city itself.
I don't see that now. Obviously, we're in a different era, and the music scene in the Bay Area is a lot different, especially now that we're in COVID. There's not a lot being performed these days. But the scene itself is more diffuse because of the internet. You don't even need to be in the same city to kind of make music. You can just trade files and put together songs that way. And that's the way people tend to collaborate now. But back when you're writing about the music scene of the early 80s, you had to be all together living, you know, maybe in the same apartment, or at least within close proximity, so you could gig and you could record, even if it was cheaply on cassette. But you had to be together. You had to be a group. Nowadays, your group as a title or a formal title, but you don't really have to live in the same city anymore. Maybe it's a lot like remote working. You know, you work for this company, but everyone's like scattered all over the country working in different places.
Very good point. It's worth noting David Kahn, who was, you might say, the unofficial A&R man / house producer for 415. He had a very particular working regimen. When he would record these bands, he would book them in a rehearsal space for a week or two where they would routine the songs until they could maybe not literally play them backward, but close to where they knew those songs. They were living and breathing those songs. And then he'd go in and record them, essentially record them live. You know, you'd go back and do, you'd track live, and then you'd go back and do overdubs and punch-ins and whatnot as needed. There's a vibe that comes from working together in that kind of close proximity that comes through in the music. And so I think part of the inimitable style of the music of that era, certainly coming out of the 415 material, is reflected in that. In some of the later stuff, you'll hear some of 80s affectations, the gunshot snare, those kind of trappings of the 80s. But for a lot of that, the music that came out on 415, you don't. It's pretty timeless. There's not a whole lot of effects layered on to the production. It sounds like what the bands sounded like. And so if you listen to live tapes of them from the era, and for a lot of these, there are live tapes, thanks to an archivist named Terry Hammer. You hear the live recordings and it's like, oh, that's what they sounded like on the record. So those records, a lot of them are really document of the live sound of those bands.
That's a great point. There is a lot of talk about the way the Beatles worked, and then they worked the song to death. If you watch the Get Back documentary, that 8-hour thing, that they got the songs to the point where they knew them so well and they wanted to do live take after live take because they were going to perform live on that rooftop. But these bands, in order to keep costs down, I think David Kahn had the right idea, was that you just do the song over and over and over till you get it right. And then we'll take it. You could just do this in your sleep. You know exactly where to come in. And so when they go out there and they perform live, like many of the bands that you profile, they sound exactly like the record. And a lot of the audience members or music fans who go to concerts, they like that. They like the fact that, oh my God, this sounds just like the record. That means that these guys really are playing. They're not just doing studio trickery. That speaks well to that era. And you said that, yeah, there's kind of a timelessness to it because this is what they sounded like on stage, and this is what they sounded like on the record, and there's not a lot of difference between the two. So it speaks well to them. And I really, really enjoyed this book. I urge all those music fans out there, if they want to learn about a time in music history, the early 80s, a specific place, San Francisco, which was fairly unique at the time, and what it was like to be in a band, by hearing from these band members about that time, recollecting on it, get Bill Kopp's book. It's called Disturbing the Peace, 415 Records, and the Rise of New Wave. And you can get it wherever you buy books. Most people buy it online, but I'm sure bookstores are going to be carrying it. And Bill, I want to thank you for being on the Planet LP podcast.
It's been my pleasure.
And that's it for now. Thank you for listening, and I'll be back very soon talking music and dropping the needle on the world of albums. Take care.